The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
This is Paul, and I'll be reading an article from the National Geographic magazine of July 2026, entitled, "The Secrets That Mummies Keep." A one-of-a-kind research institute is transforming our understanding of how our ancient ancestors lived. By Nicola Twilley. As head of the world's only institute for mummy studies, German microbiologist Frank Mexner has sampled a lot of ancient soft tissue. There were the thin, jerky-like strips of internal organs found stored in terracotta jars in a secret crypt beneath the main altar of the Medici family's chapels in Florence, Italy. Those were discovered to contain evidence of malarial infection in a preserved blood vessel. In Switzerland, the mercury-laden mummified wife of a pastor turned out to be distantly related to former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Her stomach yielded the historic genome of the bug that's still responsible for most gastric cancers and ulcers today. A Bolivian child mummy from around 700 years ago was so well preserved that her braided hair, pulled into pigtails, was soft to the touch. And of course, there were dozens of ancient Egyptians, not to mention Otzi, the fabulously well preserved Copper Age Iceman found on the border between Austria and Italy. Still, it came as something of a surprise last fall to find Mexner deep in the world's oldest operating salt mine in Hallstatt, Austria. With Daniel Brodner, who works for the Natural History Museum Vienna, he had descended into a freshly excavated section. Looped along the narrow tunnel wall, a plastic hose carrying fresh air from the surface rustled gently. Their headlamps illuminated the salt-laden rock, pressing in from all sides, transforming it into glittering pink-gray crystals. Then they found what they were looking for, an ancient human turd, embedded in the salt at about waist height. Many of Maxner's most exciting findings have come from sampling the contents of his mummy subjects' stomachs and guts, but researchers have found that same richness of human, plant, animal, microbial, and viral DNA once the material exits the body. Quote, "This is quite loaded," end quote, said Maxner, who dressed in a white Tibet jumpsuit resembling an astronaut. He knelt next to Brodner to consider the sample from all angles. It had been laid down by an Iron Age miner more than 2,000 years ago, sometime between 570 and 552 BC. Yet it seemed disturbingly fresh, down to the brawny-like texture and faint, but distinctive, aroma. Over the course of the next half hour, wielding tools that ranged from a pneumatic chisel to a paintbrush and tweezers, Brodner gradually extracted a sizable chunk of this priceless prehistoric poop. The atmosphere was tense. The pair froze each time a piece of the surrounding salt was dislodged. But thrilling, especially once Mohammed Sabri Sahan, a colleague of Maxner's at the Institute for Mummy Studies, exposed the interior of the excrement inside a portable UV-sterilized box, designed to reduce any chance of modern contamination. Deep inside the fibrous brown mass, shielded from the world for thousands of years, were hairs, two superfine and light, and two more that were thicker and darker. Quote, "We'll see if we can get some DNA from the hairs," end quote, Saharan said, popping each one into its own airtight vial. The next night, back at the Institute's headquarters in the Italian city of Bolzano, Saharan stayed up late, plating the most promising samples on petri dishes filled with nutrient-rich jelly. When we returned the next morning, it appeared these millennia-old microbes had awoken from their extended hibernation and begun to reproduce. Quote, "I was expecting one or two species, but we see a lot of stuff, even bacteria with spores," end quote, he said. Later, Maxner speculated that this could be a world first. Pending replication and review, it seemed as though Saharan has successfully cultivated at least one living microbe from an ancient human's gut. Quote, "So if this was true, then this will be a really big story," end quote, says Maxner. The discovery could offer a time machine of sorts, a way of glimpsing the ancient human microbiome in all its ancestral glory, before it was decimated by the ravages of today's ultra-processed diets. The potential for scientific discoveries that led Maxner deep into the bowels of an Austrian mountainside emerged only recently, thanks to a combination of technological breakthroughs that have revolutionized the tiny world of mummy studies, and the growing medical understanding that the contents of our guts can reveal more about us than pretty much any other part of our anatomy. For most of human history, mummies have been thought to be fascinating, spooky, and scientifically irrelevant. Skeletons were, and still are, where all the good DNA is for studying population migration and human evolution. Researchers generally favored hard evidence, bones and teeth, over softer remains, no matter how well preserved. But the past decade has seen a paradigm shift in our ability to detect and analyze all kinds of organic traces from much squishier parts of the body. The so-called, quote, omics, end quote, revolution, next-generation genetic sequencing combined with the computational power necessary to make sense of the resulting big data sets, has already transformed human health research. Now it's giving archaeologists the tools to go beyond simply figuring out the age, sex, and ancestry of an ancient human, to instead painting a holistic picture of his or her lifestyle, diet, and health, to get much closer to what it was actually like to be that person. The Institute for Mummy Studies has, since founding in 2007, become known as a leader in the field of extracting and decoding information from ancient remains, including still legible DNA for all kinds of human parasites, diseases, and microbes. This success has opened what Maxner calls, quote, "a new window back in time," end quote. And as it turns out, just like the preserved soft tissues of mummies, preserved soft feces are full of ancient biomolecules. Unfortunately, like mummies themselves, well-preserved ancient feces are rare. Under normal conditions, excrement decomposes even faster than human bodies, and in the rare cases it does survive, it has either hardened into a fossil known as a coprolite, or is jumbled together in an ancient latrine, loosened from its ties to a specific individual and date. Forget pottery and pyramids. Today, a well-preserved ancient turd is a treasure. That's why, safe in their individual salty tombs, the dozens of Hallstatt paleo feces, along with the mine's ancient wooden infrastructure, datable down to the year, represent the archaeological equivalent of winning a lottery ticket. Like most of his colleagues in the sparsely populated field of mummy studies, Maxner became an expert on organic human remains somewhat by accident. Careful, soft-voiced, and with a penchant for Hawaiian shirts, he was finishing his PhD in microbial ecology in Vienna when he saw a job listing. The description was intriguing. The Institute for Mummy Studies was looking for someone to set up a laboratory purely for the analysis of ancient DNA. But Maxner was skeptical such a thing even existed. Quote, "It took me some time to believe that there are still biomolecules actually present in these ancient artifacts," end quote, he admitted. In the early 1980s, when Michael Crichton took the idea for Jurassic Park from an entomologist studying extinct DNA at the University of California, Berkeley, the proposition that the chemically unstable double helix could survive for thousands, let alone millions of years, was pure speculation. Then, in the 1990s, following the invention of a process that allows specific genetic sequences to be extracted from vanishingly tiny traces of DNA and amplified until they are identifiable, researchers claim to find ancient genes in a 120-million-year-old weevil preserved in amber in a 16-million-year-old fossilized magnolia leaf, and more. Quote, "It appeared we were on a fast track to a new dawn in paleobiology," end quote, writes biochemist Dale Greenwalt, a researcher at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, and author of a recent book that chronicles the study of ancient biomolecules. Unfortunately, many of these early claims turned out to be false. The DNA that had been multiplied came from tiny fragments of modern contamination rather than the ancient past. The next 20 years saw, quote, "a long controversy about whether ancient DNA was authentic," end quote, said Albert Zink, a National Geographic explorer and former Institute for Mummy Studies director. Sometimes it clearly wasn't. But he and other mummy experts believe that sometimes DNA that was many thousands of years old really could be found in ancient remains. This heated debate was only put to bed in 2011 with the publication of a paper that found DNA in a mummified crocodile. Quote, "It sounds funny, but it was really a game changer," end quote, Zink told me. Quote, "It was clear that it cannot be contamination because there were no crocodiles in the lab," end quote. Next generation sequencing, which began making its way into laboratories in the 2000s, avoids the bias inherent in earlier methods. It reads all the DNA, rather than targeting particular snippets for amplification. Rigorous anti-contamination protocols conducted in special labs with equipment used only for the analysis of ancient biomolecules also helped restore credibility to the field. Nonetheless, mummies were still suspect. Zink, who first became hooked on mummies by the way of a fascination with ancient Egypt, believes Tutankhamun and his kin might be to blame for the fact that mummies historically have been overlooked by serious researchers. Quote, "I worked a lot in Egypt, and the preservation is not the best," end quote, he told me. Quote, "That's why people said there's no DNA in mummies," end quote. Despite the fact that they're neither the oldest nor the most intact, these carefully bandaged pharaohs are the first association most of us have with the term, quote, mummy, end quote. And indeed, they were the first preserved human remains to be called mummies. Curiously, this was based on a misunderstanding. The Persian word mumiya, or mumia, originally referred to a black tarry substance sourced from a handful of asphalt seeps in the deep sea region and highly regarded as a medical treatment by medieval Arab physicians. A translation mistake led apothecaries in Europe to use the visually similar and more easily available resinous secretions from ancient Egyptian corpses, selling it under the same name, which came to refer to all preserved soft tissue. For centuries, Europeans saw mummies as only ground-up medicine. But after Napoleon's failed invasion of Egypt at the turn of the 19th century, inspired a fashion for all things Egyptian, mummy mania took hold, and, quote, unwrapping, end quote, parties, where wealthy people unveiled ancient remains, more in the spirit of a P.T. Barnum than a scientific inquiry, were the hottest ticket in Europe and North America. The end result was that mummies were widely perceived as, at best, a curiosity, and at worst, once Western museums woke up to the fact that displaying other people's ancestors as some kind of freak show was not a good look, an embarrassment. When journalist Heather Pringle attended the Third World Congress of Mummy Studies in 1998, she reported that, quote, nearly everyone was gainfully employed doing something other than studying mummies, end quote. Despite the perennial hold these eerily immortal bodies exert on the popular imagination, she discovered, quote, there are a few salaried jobs and very few full-time mummy experts, end quote. Arthur Ofdehyde, a Minnesotan pathologist who is often regarded as the father of modern mummy research. He co-founded the World Congress on Mummy Studies and authored the field's definitive guide, The Scientific Studies of Mummies, in 2003, complained in the book's preface that it was, quote, still an orphan discipline, end quote. Into this voyage stepped the Institute for Mummy Studies. It was launched nearly two decades ago as part of URAC, a private research center established to study issues of interest to South Tyrol. Ötzi, the Iceman, was originally found on a glacier ridge above the Tyrolean Schnastel Valley, and after undergoing years of examination at Innsbruck University in Austria, he was finally repatriated to the South Tyrolean provincial capital in Bolzano. URAC's leadership determined that Ötzi merited an entirely new research division. Quote, the Institute for Ötzi was the first name, end quote, said Zink. Quote, I convinced the director and the president that we should rename it, because my idea was to study all kinds of mummies, end quote. Zink and his team have indeed studied all kinds of mummies ever since. Still, it was Ötzi that finally convinced Maxner that mummies were his future, especially after researchers rediscovered the Iceman's long-lost stomach. Based on initial investigations, scientists thought the 5,300-year-old Iceman's stomach had decomposed. But in 2009, the year Maxner joined the Institute, a radiologist discovered it was not only intact, but full, and had simply migrated upward during the process of mummification. In 2010, in a sampling campaign partially supported by the National Geographic Society. Utsi was defrosted long enough to retrieve some of the stomach and intestinal tissues and contents, and Maxner began his analysis. Quote, when I identified ibex in the Iceman's stomach content, that was the biggest surprise. That told me, okay, this cannot be contamination, end quote, Maxner said. Quote, it was a very special moment for sure, looking at these samples and realizing what we can do. Some of the oldest mummies in the world can be found in South America, where the Chincora people of what now is northern Chile began preserving their dead almost three millennia before Egyptian embalmers developed the process that eventually gave preserved ancient soft tissues their name. Yet most present-day South Americans don't know that many of their ancestors were mummified, thanks largely to the Catholic zeal of the invading Spanish, who thoroughly extirpated what they saw as a heathen practice. Bolivian biochemist Guido Valverde was an undergraduate studying hematology in La Paz when he stumbled across a book from the 1960s describing techniques used to determine the blood types of mummies stored at the National Museum of Archaeology of Bolivia. When he asked the museum staff about the mummies, they had no idea how many they had in the collection or even where they were. Quote, no one had access to these individuals, end quote, said Valverde. Quote, they were just left behind in the storage room at the museum, end quote. This is surprisingly common fate. Tulane University in New Orleans once rediscovered two Egyptian mummies under the bleachers of its old stadium, from where they had inadvertently attended three early Super Bowl games. Quote, it took the museum 2 or 3 years of cleaning, recovery, and recataloging the individuals to at least have a preliminary understanding of what they had, end quote, Valverde said. Quote, they ended up with 50 mummies and more than 500 human skulls. It's the largest collection of human remains in Bolivia, end quote. His interest thoroughly piqued. Valverde wanted to use this biochemical training to unlock these mummies' secrets, but there was an issue. Quote, it's very difficult to develop these projects in my country because there are no laboratories with these kinds of standards, end quote, he explained. In 2017, Valverde reached out to Maxner. Having established themselves with the success of their multi-year analysis of Utsi, Maxner and his colleagues have become go-to experts for anyone with mummies they want to learn more about. After analyzing a preliminary sample, Maxner confirmed that the DNA in the Bolivian mummies was sufficiently preserved to study. Then he suggested expanding the project's ambition by including colleagues from the Institute of Mummy Studies, who work on facial reconstruction and conservation, as well as the Horus Mummy Research Team, an international group co-led by American cardiologists Gregory Thomas and Randall Thompson, that began studying atherosclerosis in ancient remains in 2009. They have yet to find a single culture that did not suffer from hardened arteries. Finally, with all the necessary permits in place, the entire team descended on La Paz to spend 2 weeks working with the mummies, carrying out CT scans and taking more than 400 samples for molecular analysis. Among their most intriguing early findings was the DNA of Streptococcus pyrone genes. Quote, it's one of the most impressive bacteria. It can give you a cold or it can eat your flesh, end quote, Valverde told me. This is the first time the pathogen has ever been found in an ancient individual in the region. No one even knew it was present in the pre-Columbian Americas, and it seems to be a more ancestral strain than the version that circulates today, which means it could help explain the evolution of this exclusively human-associated bacteria. What's more, the sample also contained genetic material from ancient viruses that attack this bacteria. Maxner told me that biomedical researchers think these could hold the key to developing a treatment that is effective against a broad spectrum of streptococci, including the ones that are responsible for millions of cases of pneumonia, meningitis, and inflammatory heart disease every year. Meanwhile, though it was not part of their original plan, Maxner and Valverde discovered that some of the ancient Bolivians had existing openings in their abdominal cavities through which the scientists could extract feces without causing any additional damage. Quote, "It turns out these are the most precious samples," end quote, said Valverde. The full analysis, which Valverde expects will shed new light on the otherwise virtually unknown pre-Columbian gut microbiome, is still underway. The preliminary findings are groundbreaking, but for Maxner, they're also frustrating. Quote, "Even though mummies are beautiful, and I like them a lot, they have a limitation," end quote, he told me. "The thing that makes them so special, their exceptional, even unique preservation, contains their relevance." Quote, "It's only one. It's an example. It's a case study," end quote, Maxner said, quoting typical responses to mummy research. Quote, "Those are our most hated words," end quote. Modern scientific studies pin the validity of their insights on replication, statistical significance, and representative sampling. The discovery of DNA in a single mummy can never conclusively make the case that ancient South Americans regularly ate quinoa or suffered from strep, which is why Maxner was so excited when he heard the salt mine in Austria contained dozens, maybe even hundreds, of perfectly preserved paleo feces. The town of Hallstatt, set on a deep blue lake surrounded by alpine peaks, is so breathtakingly picturesque that in 2012, Chinese developers constructed a near replica as a luxury community in Guangdong Province. Selfie-stick-wielding tourists overflow the original, but most of them remain unaware of the real reason for the town's existence: a salt deposit that has been mined for 7,000 years, creating a site so important within archaeological circles that has been given its name to the entire proto-Celtic Hallstatt culture of late Bronze Age to early Iron Age Europe. Quote, "For prehistoric societies and all the thousands of years before that, we need to remember that salt is vital," end quote, said Daniel Bradner from the National Historic Museum, Vienna. Quote, "Without salt, you can't survive," end quote. "Not only do we need to consume about a quarter of a teaspoon a day to prevent metabolic malfunction and death, but without refrigeration, salt was essential for food preservation. During the late Bronze Age and for much of the Iron Age, Hallstatt was the main supplier of salt for Central and Eastern Europe. The mine is still operational today. Every year, Salonen Austria AG extracts 400 Olympic swimming pools worth of brine from the subterranean deposit to produce 320,000 tons of salt. Bradner led us into the mine via a tunnel dug in the 1700s, We walked single file, stepping on the ties of the narrow gauge railway that miners used to transport their gear. The smooth, whitewashed walls at the entrance soon gave way to dark, roughly chiseled rock, streaked with veins of the pink-gray salt. The air was cool and humid, with the sound of water slowly dripping in the background. The prehistoric sites inside the mountain have all been discovered by accident, when early modern miners stumbled upon what came to be known as Heidengebirge, a German term used to refer to heathen areas. Researchers can't just probe the mountain for empty voids because they've been filled up, either slowly by salt creep, under pressure rock salt flows like a liquid, closing up tunnels at a rate of about a half an inch a year, or quickly, during landslides that still threaten the area. One of those cave-ins, in 660 BC, resulted in Hallstatt's only recorded human mummy, an Iron Age miner trapped underground. The so-called, quote, man in the salt, end quote, was found in 1734, with his leather shoes and some clothing intact, according to contemporary descriptions. Quote, unfortunately, it was too early for science, end quote, said Bradner. Quote, they brought him down to the priests and decided to bury him, without noting where. He's never been seen since, though Bradner suspects there may be more mummies concealed in the mountain. Only around 2% of the mine's ancient workings have been excavated. We followed Bradner up, down, and along the tight passages, crouching and slithering our way through a series of twisty, under-illuminated wormholes for 20 minutes, until he came to a stop in a small room, more than 300 feet beneath the earth's surface. Quote, we are standing in the old Bronze Age cavity, end quote, he said. Quote, the catastrophe is all around us, end quote. The landslides were a stroke of luck for future archaeologists, because the mined voids were stuffed full of debris from the surface. Their original dimensions were maintained. By drilling boreholes through the fill at different angles, Bradner has established that the original chamber was vast, at least four stories tall and the size of nearly five tennis courts laid side by side. All around us lay big limestone boulders, rubble, smashed wooden timbers, and an entire maple tree, dirt still clinging to its web of roots. Nearby, beech trunks were used to precisely date its final year in the sunshine to 1063 BC. Beneath us was the negative imprint of a staircase, cast like a shadow into the fill. The original, an intact 3,100-year-old wooden structure that is the world's oldest known staircase, was safely stored in a climate-controlled room closer to the mine's entrance. All around us, jutting out from the walls, were spectacular organic remains that looked as though they had been left there yesterday. A fragment from a fur cap, half a pickaxe, and a thick rope made of braided fibers from the inner bark of lime trees, but no feces. This excremental absence was pointed out with typical frankness by Kirsten Koerich, a specialist in prehistoric archaeology at the Austrian Academy of Sciences. Quote, the Iron Age is full of shit, end quote, she said. Quote, in the Bronze Age, it's much more rare, end quote. There are just six known Bronze Age poops at Hallstatt, and they are the only confirmed human remains from that era in the mine. Bradner assumes that this disparity in deposits is the outcome of the era's different mining styles. In the Bronze Age, salt was mined downward, whereas in the Iron Age, miners worked in horizontal chambers. Quote, "It makes no sense to shit on the floor where you're mining downward," end quote, he said. Quote, "But in the Iron Age, they don't care. They just leave it where it fell," end quote. The Hallstatt feces have been studied since the 1930s. An earlier generation of archaeologists dissected them under the microscope to find parasite eggs and botanical remains. But no one had performed a molecular analysis until 2019, when Maxner and his colleagues conducted preliminary tests on three feces from an Iron Age chamber and one from the Bronze Age, just to see whether there were enough intact ancient biomolecules to merit further study. To Maxner's surprise, the DNA was astonishingly undamaged despite its age. From the lining of the gut wall came enough human genetic material to establish that each lump of excrement was unmixed product of a separate individual, and all four were male. The microbial DNA was even more plentiful, yielding sufficient data to allow Maxner and Sarhan to compare the guts of these miners with present-day indigenous populations, which they resembled much more closely than they did modern Westerners. In particular, the team examined the diversity of a common gut microbe, Prevotella copri, which is associated with plant-based unprocessed diets. All four feces contain the full repertoire of the microbe's complex carbohydrate processing capabilities, whereas westernized guts typically lack some of that functionality. Quote, "This is something we've lost," end quote, said Maxner. Curiously, one of the feces looked different from the others, less fibrous and more finely textured. Radiocarbon analysis revealed it actually dated back only to the 1700s. But despite lacking the seed husks and straw of the older poop, it still looked more like the indigenous microbiome than the Western one. Quote, "Somewhere after the Baroque period is where it all went wrong," end quote, said Maxner. The feces also contained enough DNA and proteins from food to allow the team to reconstruct the miner's diet. Based on microscopic plant and bone remains, Hallstatt miners have been thought to rely heavily on fava bean, millet, barley, and meat stew similar to a dish named rishak that's still eaten in the region today. Traces of those ingredients were found in the samples, but one of the two Iron Age feces also contained walnut DNA, a luxury product that would have been imported from hundreds of miles away, as well as a telltale signal of the microbes involved in making blue cheese and beer, in what was also the first molecular evidence for their consumption in Iron Age Europe. Sarhan studied these microbes in detail to establish whether they showed signs of being domesticated or wild. In other words, whether the miners were intentionally cultivating microbes to produce particular flavors in their fermented foods. By comparing the penicillin genome in the Iron Age group poop, the mold used to make modern blue cheeses, such as Roquefort, as well as to its wild food spoilage related relatives, along the evolutionary path to being a purely cheese-focused microbe. Similarly, the yeast appeared to be closest to those used to make today's pale ales. Quote, "They were actively looking for specific tastes," end quote, concluded Kowarik. Quote, "It's evidence of an ancient cuisine," end quote. Lost flavors that, thanks to their microbial traces, we can now not only identify, but perhaps also even taste ourselves one day. (Clears throat) These proof-of-concept samples were retrieved pre-COVID. Thanks to the pandemic, combined with the bureaucracy of scientific grant-making, the teams returned to the mine to sample dozens more feces had been significantly delayed. Quote, I've been to the mine 3 or 4 times now, and each time I'm like, please, Daniel, give me the sample. End quote. Sarhan said as we unpacked the scientific equipment. Quote, now we're actually doing the samples. It's like a dream. End quote. The team members set themselves up in a small chamber carved off the main tunnel. Bradner was equipped with a red clipboard listing the feces and their find sites. Sarhan had a box of coffee-filled chocolates to keep his energy levels high. After a slow start, the group fell into a rhythm. Bradner photographed each specimen. Maxner cleaned and weighed them. Then Maximilian Peniel, an archaeobotanist, surveyed the specimens for visible plant parts, which Sarhan, working in a clean suit and sterile glove box, delicately tweezered out as he exposed the untouched interior of each excrement for the first time in thousands of years to extract his crumb-sized samples. After 3 days, the team had sampled 30 feces. Sarhan was jubilant. In the entire scientific canon, he told me, there are fewer than 20 published molecular analyses of paleofeces performed using the latest technology, and about half of them have been done by the team at the Institute for Mummy Studies. Quote, we doubled this, and we plan to do 20 more from the museum storage in Vienna, end quote, he said, slapping his hands on the table for emphasis. At long last, Maxner told me, he will have assembled enough evidence to transcend the solo case study limitations inherent in mummy research, enough to be able to make authoritative statements about these ancient salt miners, from their taste preferences to their metabolic health to their parasite and disease burden. The full analysis will take 2 years and involve partners in labs around the globe, but already it seems clear that the insights these feces will provide are intriguing. Kavorik rattled off a long list of questions she hoped might finally receive answers. Did everyone eat dairy? Did what they eat change over the seasons? How much meat did they eat, and from which parts of the animal, and how did they process it? Maybe, she speculated, they'll even solve, quote, the case of the missing fish, end quote. Archaeologists have found no fish bones and no fish-related parasites from the first millennium in Halsat. Yet some of the Iron Age miners were buried with fish hooks. Sarhan, who has a background in plant pathology, was particularly thrilled to find what he thinks is an intact wheat kernel with signs of smut, of fungal disease that can still wipe out harvests. The information contained in both of those genomes could ultimately help farmers today. Bradner estimates that only a couple dozen people mined the salt works at one time, given that many of the Iron Age samples came from an area mined over the course of just 18 years. It's possible they'll even have more than one sample from the same person, and thus be able to build a biochemical portrait of a single individual's diet and health as that person aged. Quote, the combination of clear dating and still having all this information in the form of biomolecules, this is something unique, end quote, said Maxner, who was so excited and yet so sleep-deprived by the end of the week that he seemed almost delirious. Quote, this is truly a new way to travel back in time, end quote. A couple of days later, we met in the mountains again, this time on the Italian side of the Alps, at Archeopark Schanastal, near where Ötzi was found. The sky was still bright blue, but the air was cold, and the larch-covered mountainsides glinted gold with the turning of the season. While Kowarik and Bradner excavate artifacts, and Maxner and Sarhan extract biomolecules, the Akio Park practices another technique for understanding the past, experimental archaeology. Its director, Johanna Niedenklöffler, has frequently collaborated with Maxner and his colleagues to make sense of these findings, while her partner, Stefan Tepnier, peeled feathery tissues from a big ridged bracket fungus and then struck two rocks together, again and again, to light them with a spark. She explained that the purpose of the experimental archaeology is to learn by doing. If we lit a fire, sliced meat and dried it in the same way the Iceman might have done, for example, what else would we realize in the process? And would we end up with the same stomach contents, molecularly speaking? To help make sense of Utsi's last meal, Maxner had asked Niederklöffler to dry flint-cut meat in different ways. The results helped guide his ongoing analyses. As we sat around the fire in the honeyed autumn light, bathing in its warmth and smoke while hungrily watching the meat we'd sliced using a flint knife dry and flatbreads we'd made from the grain we'd ground up puff and burnish, Maxner explained why he brought me here. The new tools he and his colleagues have brought to the study of preserved ancient biomolecules, whether in mummies or feces, are enlarging our understanding of the past by leaps and bounds. Quote, but you can't explain these results without all the other tools of archaeology, end quote, he insisted. Quote, you have to combine, end quote. By trying to recreate the cheese that miners at Hallstatt ate, or the beer they drank, he said, we can see more clearly what we do not know and what we still is interpretation. Repeat. By trying to recreate the cheese that miners at Hallstatt ate, or the beer they drank, he said, we could see more clearly what we do know and what we do not. What is still interpretation? We sat, talking and eating, a long way from the lab in Bolzano or even the salt mines at Hallstatt, immersed in an entirely different, more embodied understanding of the past. Quote, this was a world for a long time, end quote, said Niederklöffler softly. Mummies, perhaps precisely because they preserve the tender part of humankind, the part that hurts and bleeds, eats and poops, speak to us. Finally, we have the tools to listen. The end. This is Paul, and I will be reading an article from the National Geographic magazine of July 2026 in a section called In the Field. The title, can these tiny insects stop the next wildlife pandemic? The lowly blowfly is known for feasting on feces and corpses. In Tennessee, one intrepid researcher hopes to use them as a biological warning system for disease. By Jacqueline Detweiler George. In a panoramic Appalachian meadow in Great Smoky Mountains National Park, a pair of scientists hover over a nebula of little black flies. Unlike visitors in town for the early fall elk rut, Charity Owings, a University of Tennessee assistant professor and National Geographic explorer, and her graduate student, Makeli Voss, aren't particularly interested in catching a glimpse of the park's charismatic megafauna. Instead, they've set up a small plastic canister stuffed with putrid chicken livers, fumes wafting off of them like vapors from a cartoon pie. The flies love it. Voss slaps a net over the entomological melee, surprising the insects into flight. And before they can escape, she whips her haul into a figure-eight pattern to force them into the net's bottom. It's an impressive move, balletic even. Quote, "Who taught you to do that?" end quote, Owings quips. Quote, "You did," end quote. Owings and Voss study blowflies, a family of insects that gorge and lay their eggs on decaying animal flesh and feces. True crime fans will be familiar with the power of these flies as tools of science. Forensic entomologists log cycles of blowfly egg laying and maggot maturation in a corpse to reveal how much time has passed since a person died. But Owings and her team are using the insects to solve other types of mysteries, such as, in the case of today's experiment, whether a tapeworm parasite called Echinococcus granulosus is spreading through the Great Smokies elk population. Blowflies carry their stomach clues about the world around them, including DNA from the animals they touch or chemicals those animals have encountered. Owings and her team are using a revolutionary method she co-developed in graduate school to test the fly's stomach contents for DNA from bacteria, viruses, and parasites. Quote, "Our whole goal is to try to make surveillance of pathogens really quick and easy," end quote, Owings says. Instead of spending time and money trying to locate sick animals and test them, the team can gather nearby flies and analyze them in the field. Quote, "That's a game changer," end quote, she says. Some biologists think Echinococcus might have arrived in elk brought down from Canada during a species reintroduction effort, which has since created a local reservoir for the tapeworm. The worry is that the parasite, which can form large cysts in the heart, lungs, and liver, could spread to carriers like coyotes and domestic dogs, and eventually humans. A few hours later, at a motel in North Carolina's rural Maggie Valley, Voss carries the desk from her room over to Owings to construct a makeshift laboratory next to the TV. The scientists cut off the flies' abdomens with scissors and a pair of pointed tweezers, smash them with a few drops of DNA extraction liquid, and place them into a white and orange laptop-sized console called a bento lab before heading out to grab some pizza. The bento lab is a portable DNA analysis machine created by a pair of students at University College London to bring the kind of hard science normally performed in labs out into the field. When Owings read about the device in a paper by a team of scientists who were using it to analyze seawater on a boat, she knew it would be perfect for analyzing fly guts. While Owings and Voss are gone, the bento lab runs the abdomens through cycles of PCR, polymerase chain reactions, and amplifying the DNA pattern associated with Echinococcus until it can be seen as an obvious line on a gel electrophoresis screening tool. It's simple work if you're a researcher. A long-term goal is to make the on-location analysis even easier by creating something akin to a COVID or pregnancy test that an ecologist or a park ranger without any scientific training could use. The road to such a test could be a long one. Silver testing tools would require the help of chemists and production designers, not to mention funding. In the morning, preliminary results have come back positive for echinococcus. After running more tests for confirmation, Owings and her team will alert the Tennessee Wildlife Resource Agency and work jointly on a plan to mitigate the parasite's spread. They can inform public health officials, local veterinarians, and the public of the risk, but it's not feasible to treat infected elk. The next day, Owings and Voss head over to collect more flies near the park's Okunofokti Visitor Center and meet up with their colleague Richard Gernhold, a veterinarian parasitologist who has helped Owings come up with a new application for her research. Quote, "We are only limited by funding in our imagination," end quote, he says of flies' potential as an ecological tool. Already, Owings and her colleagues have used data from the blowflies to track chemicals commonly used in chemical weapons materials, an undertaking supported by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency that could eventually be used in conflict zones. Owings can rattle off a list of other possible uses that range from locating missing hikers through their DNA to identifying new animal species. Quote, "There's always a new question," end quote, she says. Inevitably, the response is, quote, "Well, let's test it," end quote. The end.
This is Bird Note. Rock climbing on Eagle Cliff in New Hampshire's Franconia Notch State Park requires perfect focus on the points of contact between climber and mountain. And keeping an eye out for peregrine falcons whipping by. These granite cliffs are important for peregrines. In fact, each year, popular climbing routes in the area close temporarily to give nesting falcons their space. Historically, peregrines bred throughout New Hampshire's White Mountains, but widespread use of the pesticide DDT caused them to disappear from the state and throughout eastern North America by the 1960s. Biologists released captive-raised peregrines, hoping to reestablish the species in the wild. In 1981, Eagle Cliff hosted a successful peregrine nest, the first on a natural rock face in the eastern U.S. since the population crashed. Since then, state agencies and New Hampshire Audubon have worked with rock climbing groups to decide when to close cliffs in the summer. Rock climbing biologists and volunteers have a unique role to play. They venture up to remote falcon nests to fit metal ID bands on the legs of peregrine chicks, helping scientists track the peregrine falcon's recovery. Climbers continue to enjoy the granite cliffs of New Hampshire, and they've helped ensure they're not alone on the mountain. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Hi, the Bay State Council of the Blind has available free Braille copies of a new publication from the CDC. It's entitled COVID-19 Vaccination Guidance, and this one-volume publication focuses on information about the vaccines and vaccine safety. To get your free copy, send your name and mailing address to kim.charlson@perkins.org. That's kim.charlson@perkins.org.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Have you heard about the Audio Journal show, Young at Heart? It's okay to be young at heart. The show is about listening to simple stories about simple and happy tales of life. By listening to Young at Heart, you will experience the delight and wonder of being, well, young at heart. And since laughter is the best medicine, many of the stories will also make you smile, chuckle, or even laugh out loud. So pull up a comfy chair, take off your shoes, and bend your ears to the Audio Journal show, Young at Heart, every Saturday and Sunday at 2 o'clock p.m.